Meanwhile, British experts have arrived in Nigeria to help in the hunt for over 200 kidnapped girls. Presidential spokesman Doyin Okupe says they're searching a massive area.
We have never really turned down assistance. You know, we've always had an open mind about this. I haven't been able to find them yet. It's not because we don't have the capacity. It's because the terrain is difficult.
That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Apologies, during the news, sounded like Rupert Murdoch's Sky News got shot up a bit by Vladimir Putin over in the Ukraine somehow. But anyway, we're here and we're ready to go. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news as the Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. How long until an American sheriff takes over Avon and Somerset Police? Well, it sounds like a joke, but the first ads are out there. And the Israelis and NATOs are just setting up a new regime change command centre in Amman, Jordan, aimed to topple the government of Syria and Iran. But who decided that that's a good idea? Because it wasn't us. On a similar theme, Putin tells East Ukrainian separatists not to hold a referendum this weekend. Will they and should they take any notice? Also, some more from last week's mind-boggling interviewee. He's the US, Iraq and Ukraine war game designer, Joseph Miranda. This week he tells us about his game Battle for Baghdad that went down a storm at the Pentagon back in 2000. Also from last week, US is taking over Channel 5 TV. More from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom's Granville Williams on how the desire of a handful of corporations to control almost everything we read, see and hear is spreading to the internet too. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16, sunshine and showers during the weekend, and also some strong gusty winds. Next week, highs of 21, temperatures heading up, sunshine and showers again, but feeling warmer as the week wears on. Next weekend, that's 17th and 18th of May, again, highs 16 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Hi, Stephen, welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, everybody.
Now, also, you are now a Minister for Communities. What does that mean?
I'm a minister in the Department of Communities and Local Government. As the Lib Dem minister in the department, I have oversight of everything it does, from sort of housing policy to local economic development. But my specific responsibilities are community cohesion and integration. That includes race equality. Also localism and community rights, things such as neighbourhood plans. So there's one in Old Market, there's one in Redcliffe, one in Lotleys, underway in Bristol. And these are really interesting. Things like housing standards and building regulations. So it's quite a disparate range.
Race is a big one, isn't it? Because there's a lot of debate about immigration. Do you think UKIP is a racist party?
I wouldn't put them in the same bracket as the BNP, which clearly is a racist, nasty, quasi-fascist party. I'm sure there are elements amongst their membership who are probably racist, but I wouldn't say per se they're a racist party. I think they're a misguided, stupid party.
But do you think all the
Britain's
all the
places are outside the European Union, which is obviously, as a Liberal Democrat, that's something I fundamentally disagree with, because I think we are better off in the European Union.
Well, we're going to be talking about this in the second hour, Stephen, but you know, the EU at the moment is backing the new regime in Kiev. It has been for a long time. And we've seen some pretty horrific attacks, racist attacks, over the last, should we say, 2 weeks or so, maybe a little bit longer. Many people are accusing elements of the new regime in Ukraine of being racist. So why would we be backing the EU if the EU is backing the fascists in Ukraine?
I don't think you could call the new the interim government in Kiev a fascist government.
But there is the right sector party, isn't there? The right sector party is in the government, which is a fascist party. Many people say that.
The key thing about... I think one of the big successes of the European Union is, in certainly my lifetime and yours, Tony, fascist dictatorships in Portugal, Greece and Spain have joined the European Union. Communist dictatorships behind the Iron Curtain have joined the European Union. Now we just have the former Yugoslav republics to come into the European Union. And I was in Bosnia recently as leading a delegation of young people to understand how hatred can cause problems. But Croatia is now in the EU. Serbia, Bosnia and possibly Kosovo will be in the European Union, I'm sure, in the next 5 years or so, and possibly Ukraine as well. And as all of these, as all of the European family comes together in one political and trading club, a lot of the difficulties that the continent has suffered from for centuries start to fade away. And that's the big achievement of the European Union, and that's why it's still attractive, that's why people still want to join it, and indeed the single currency as well, which is still growing.
What about immigration, though? Because one of the main argument used by UKIP is simply that what's happening is there's too much immigration and that it's eroding paying conditions in this country as many people come into Britain, and slowly but surely what we're seeing is the number of jobs available going down and also the general job security. Things like, with full employment, there's no way employers, for example, could bring in contracts or bad contracts or what else the word I'm looking for?
Zero hours
contracts. That sort of thing. It can only happen when you've got lots and lots of people clamouring for the jobs and not enough jobs to go around.
Well, first of all, employment in this country is at an all-time high. About 30 million people are in work, and that's the highest number of people that have ever been working in the country's history. Unemployment, of course, has consistently fallen for over a year now. In my Bristol West parliamentary seat, unemployment is now below where it was in May 2010 at the time of the last general election. So the Bristol economy is in a very strong position, and the rest of the country is recovering too. I think immigration is a good thing. I think it's enriched our society, both in Bristol and around the country. Just walking around my constituency, seeing faces from all over the world, visiting schools, like I was in Sefton Park School just before I came here, handing out certificates to the children who've been raising money for a community finance project in Africa. But the interesting thing is, of course, the children in that assembly in Sefton Park School, their parents had come from all over the world as well. I think that's something to be celebrated and proud of, the fact that Britain has actually largely done this in a successful way. And I think politicians are of two types. They're either cynical people who play on people's fears, and that's where Farage and UKIP and some people in other parties come from as well. Or you're optimistic about the human spirit. You want to play to the best of humanity, and that's what liberals seek to do.
Okay, some of this week's news, but today's to start with. Plan to let HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue Custom, that's the tax man to you and me, take tax debt straight from bank accounts, and it's under fire already. This is in today's Independent. An influential group of MPs has attacked controversial government plan that would allow a taxman to seize debt straight from the public's personal bank accounts. Cross-party Treasury Committee expressed considerable concern over Chancellor George Osborne's new proposals for tax collection, calling for far greater scrutiny over the plans. What are your thoughts on this one, Stephen? I know it's only just hit the headlines today, but this is what HMRC are saying is, look, we need more powers to collect tax. We're having trouble doing it because it's becoming more and more difficult to persuade people to hand over their cash.
Well, this is the first I've seen of this particular plan, but certainly something I've spoken about a lot, because before I became Communities Minister last October, I was the Lib Dems Treasury spokesman in the Commons, and one of the issues I talked about a lot was how we can do more as a government to tackle tax avoidance and evasion. Of course, the classic evasion is simply not paying the tax that is due. So we do have to look at every mechanism for recovery tax if it's proven to be owed by somebody, and there are already sort of court procedures where a levy can be put on your salary and so on to recover tax.
But one of the things with
this is about
is that they're saying that they won't need to go to court. They will just be able to sip. It's a bit like a direct debit, I suppose. Just take it from your account. They won't have to actually put evidence in front of a court. HMRC will simply be able to
I'd be surprised if it was as simple as that. So this is a newspaper report which I've only just literally just seen. I'll have a look at it, but as a Liberal, I'm suspicious of giving the state too much power over individuals' lives in every circumstance. I wouldn't want any agency of the state just to decide for itself that it can take money from people or take liberty away from people. I would want a due process to come in, and for there to be some
sort
of court proceeding.
You would be aligned with the Treasury Committee, which is expressing concerns. The weird thing about this is it doesn't seem to say anything about taking money from businesses like Starbucks or McDonald's. It just seems to be talking about individuals' tax returns. Martin, what are your thoughts about this announcement today? The Treasury wants to be able to take debt without going to court, straight from people's bank accounts.
Well, most people actually, if they're employees, pay as you earn. So in other words, the money's taken out of their wage.
I think what they're saying is increasingly people are not. I mean, for example, people have been put onto tax credits and many are self-employed now who were on the dole.
Well, that's right. But I mean, but in actual fact, most employees, I still think it's probably true now, most employees have tax taken off their salary before they even see it. So in other words, what we're talking about here is people who don't have their tax taken off them, presumably business people or self-employed people. And, you know, we all agree that these things have got to be fair. But, I mean, let's face it, employees have tax taken off their salaries before they even see the salaries.
Are you something of a poacher turned gamekeeper, Stephen? Because I know before you were an MP, you were working with PricewaterhouseCoopers on advising companies on how to pay as little tax as possible.
Yeah, so within the law. No tax consultant, which is indeed what I was, advises people to evade tax, which is illegal, or to go down very aggressive avoidance schemes. That's simply not what I did.
But would you say setting up another?
I was the tax accountant for the RAC, made sure the payroll function worked well, the people's car benefit was reported correctly.
Would you say setting up another arm of your business in another country is an aggressive way of?
Yes.
Tax?
Oh yeah.
Because that happens all the time now.
I'm on the record on many occasions as speaking against that and urging the government to do more about it. And the thing is, this coalition government has done more to block the various avenues that are available both to individuals and multinationals to avoid tax than any previous government, both in terms of our domestic law, but also working in cooperation across the European Union and the OECD to look at tax treaties to make sure that the likes of Starbucks, Amazon would be the other big example. In fact, a much bigger and more relevant example than Starbucks, which is small beer in the scheme of things, to try and block the avenues that are available for them to avoid tax. But it's also down to the consumer. What I'd say to you, everyone who's listening to this program at the moment, consumer power, you can really make a difference. Why don't you stop shopping at Amazon or email Amazon and say, I'm not going to buy a book or a DVD or any other product from you, because I'm unhappy with the fact that although you source the products from a warehouse in Swansea or somewhere else, I think it's in Dundee in Scotland, but you say for tax purposes you do it from Luxembourg. That's simply not true. You headquarter yourself in Luxembourg, so you can pay 3% VAT, but that's how they come up with their big saving.
But the trouble is, of course, if they're dodging tax, shall we say, then they're able to offer a much cheaper price, and people will take that, won't they?
This is the political dilemma for somebody like me. I just said power lies in the hands of the consumer as well as lawmakers like me. Why do people shop at Amazon? It's because it's cheaper than the high street. And what I say when I talk to audiences about tax avoidance and tax justice issues, lots of church groups, for instance, and I ask people to put up their hands up, saying how many of you shopped at Amazon for Christmas last year. It's usually virtually everyone. And why do you do it? Because it's cheaper. The reason it's cheaper is because they avoid tax.
Well, let's go on to the AstraZeneca-Pfizer story. We did touch on this a little bit last week. I was remembering the takeover by Kraft of Cadbury's and the promises that we were given then about jobs at Keynsham. But this is in this week's Mirror. Cabinet Secretary used to work for the bank, is now advising AstraZeneca on the Pfizer bid. Whitehall Mandarin spearheading the government's talks over Pfizer's $63 billion bid for AstraZeneca, used to work for an investment Development Bank involved with the proposed deal. Cabinet Secretary Sir Jeremy Hayward, Britain's top civil servant, is leading negotiations between the two firms on behalf of Prime Minister David Cameron. But Sir Jeremy, one of Britain's most powerful men, once worked for the US bank Morgan Stanley, which is advising AstraZeneca in the takeover fight. Do you think there's a bit of a conflict of interest there, Steve?
No, I think you can pull facts out about people's past and say, does it give them a current conflict of interest? Well, clearly it doesn't. He works for the government. He works for the civil service, as he has done for a long time. The political objectivity here is, what is the business secretary doing? My colleague Vince Cable, and he's all over this issue in terms of trying to make sure that if a corporate deal happens, that there are safeguards in place to make sure that British jobs are protected, but just as importantly, that our scientific research base is protected as well. The irony is, for all the fluster and bluster from Ed Miliband and his colleagues, is of course there isn't a public interest test in corporate takeovers anymore. And why is that? It's because they abolished it.
Now let's go to have a listen directly to Vince Cable now, and here's a clip from as soon as the MPs came back from their Easter break. There was discussion on Tuesday, and we're going to hear from several of them now. We start with Lib Dem Vince Cable, then there's Labour's Chuka Ramunna, and then the Tory Crispin Blunt. Finally, Vince Cable again.
The government must and will approach it from the position of even-handed neutrality and recognise that this is ultimately a matter for the shareholders of both companies. One of our options as the government would be to consider using our public interest test powers. This would be a serious step and not one that should be taken lightly. And I'm open-minded about it, while stressing that we are operating within serious European legal constraints. We see the future of the UK as a knowledge economy, not a tax haven. And our focus is on what is best for the UK, securing great British science, research and manufacturing jobs and decision-making in the life sciences sector.
Pfizer has said it's committed to making a long-term investment in the UK through this purchase. Similar assurances were given to other companies acquired by Pfizer in the US and in Sweden. Subsequently, research facilities were shut down and thousands of high-skilled jobs lost. Why should we believe the same fate will not befall AstraZeneca? The assurances the government has extracted from Pfizer are simply not worth the paper they are written on, are they? If I am wrong on that, why, less than 3 days after giving them, did Pfizer's CEO say yesterday, following completion of the AstraZeneca takeover, it would be split into three parts, all of which could subsequently be flogged off afterwards?
My constituents' experience of Pfizer in hosting the development and occupation of their award-winning headquarters at Walton Oaks is of a model corporate citizen. And I think what is enervating some people in the House is the fact that this is a fantastic vote of confidence in the United Kingdom and gives us the possibility of hosting the world's leading research-based pharmaceutical company in the United Kingdom as a consequence.
My senior colleagues in government have been engaged in discussion with both companies, making the points about the national interest that I've been...
Yeah, sorry, we got Vince got cut off at the end there, but MP for Bristol West Lib Dem, Stephen Williams, a model corporate citizen. Do you think Pfizer is that?
I'll describe any enormous multinational as a model corporate citizen, because somewhere in the world you'll find something that you won't approve of. As one of my ministerial responsibilities is local economic development, I visited a site in Kent recently where Pfizer had closed their major UK factory in Deal, I think it was in Kent, and had withdrawn sort of, I think it was several thousand jobs. So that's something that they've done in the past, which shows that they haven't always acted in the best interests of the United Kingdom science base. And that's the sort of thing that no doubt Vince Cable and the Prime Minister will be discussing with them, that if they are going to take over AstraZeneca, how much will they be invested in the UK's science base to make sure we do the research and development in this country, but also the manufacturing too.
But they're being criticised for this thing called tax inversion. This is what apparently Pfizer are trying to do. And we've heard today that a US senator is criticising them for it. He's vowing to act fast to close the tax loophole, which would allow Pfizer to re-domicile in Britain. This is in the Telegraph. Pfizer's $63 billion approach for AstraZeneca was attacked on a new front today after a powerful US senator pledged to close that loophole. The US pharmaceutical giant said it wants to acquire its British rival partly to expand its drugs portfolio, but also to reduce the tax bill that it currently pays in the US.
They regard it as a bitter pill. But
by domiciling in the UK, a process known as inversion. The idea being that they will have to pay less tax if they pay it in the UK than the US, Stephen.
More tax therefore will be paid in the United Kingdom. You might say that if they do domicile themselves in the United Kingdom by merging with an existing British company, as long as we've got the safeguards in place for jobs and for science research and development, and we get a good corporate tax deal out of it as well, then that could be a very good deal. But that's the sort of discussions that Vince Cable and co. will be having with them.
Martin, what about the... Does it make any difference whether that profit is made and paid in Britain or in the United States for Britain? Isn't this quite an important strategic industry that Britain needs to have actually living and based here rather than in the US?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that we are talking about takeovers as being in the national interest or not in the national interest. And I take the point that Stephen made earlier that the last Labour government removed the national interest considerations from such takeovers, although now they want to talk about it. I think on a wider point, don't forget that most of these companies make their money ultimately from the taxpayer via things like the NHS. We've got the NHS in this country, but there's public health care in most developed countries in the world. And ultimately, that is the market that these companies are selling to. In other words, in actual fact, these are not really private companies. Without the state's intervention, they wouldn't exist. And therefore, there's a very strong case for the state, the British state, the US state, other states, to control their activities pretty tightly.
But Stephen, aren't what they're doing just taking out the competition so they can start fixing the prices? Because, I mean, that's one of their main competitors. And if they can take them out of the way, they can start to control the market, charge anything they want for their pills.
I'm not an expert on the sort of pharmaceutical industry.
That's what I would do if I was
on it. I don't think they compete in that sense of, you know, there's that they will, AstraZeneca will have one drug for, breast cancer or something, and Pfizer will have a rival drug. I don't think they compete with each other in that sense. But certainly, investing in new treatments is enormously expensive for both of these companies, so there may well be an economic benefit by them pooling their sort of
but they'll be in a position
knowledge,
I mean,
in order, and you know, humanity could benefit. Corporate deals, which is something I used to do, as you like reminding people, is not necessarily a bad thing if they can do things more efficiently.
But it is if they can set the price, isn't it, if there isn't any real competition in what they're doing. I mean, there are other big pharmaceutical companies around the world, but this is going to take out major threat to their pricing, isn't it?
Yes, but the NHS has enormous buying power, and I actually wish the NHS would use its enormous buying power more effectively in terms of driving down prices in the UK.
Martin,
Pfizer's biggest, most famous product, of course, is Viagra, which I don't think you can get on the NHS.
Martin, this whole business of whether it should be in the public sector or the private sector, I mean, when you've got a company that's so big it can start to control the market, or it's part of a cartel and they start to fix the prices, isn't it time to think about the legislation telling that company, actually, either you're going to have to split up or else the state should come in and control it?
Well, this raises fundamental questions about competition policy, and I would argue that in actual fact certain things are that you've got economies of scale, which mean that it is logical, in fact, to have big organisations doing these kind of activities like developing new drugs. But in that case, then you haven't really got a competition, and in that case, you've then got to develop a strategy for managing those companies, or quite possibly, I know this is pie in the sky, but developing a public sector alternative. And of course, in developing countries, they've been very unhappy with these big drug companies for years, because they want to actually produce generic versions of basic drugs, and patent law prevents them from doing it.
And big issue for the third world. Yeah,
yeah, So, I mean, I would argue, I mean, I know this is absolute pie in the sky, but ultimately these kind of things should, in fact, be run in the public sector, because the economies of scale mean that you can't have proper competition, and if you can't have proper competition, you might as well manage it directly. There's no reason for anybody to make money out of healthcare.
I also wonder where Pfizer are getting this $63 billion to do this takeover bid from. Is this QE money?
They're borrowing it.
But is it real money, or is it money that's just been sort of created by the US banks in order to keep the US economy going? Because, I mean, they're printing a fantastic amount of money at the moment, aren't they?
Well, I don't think any of us knows where Pfizer are getting their money from.
63.
It's probably likely that they are floating on QE. I mean, the whole economy is floating on that. The world economy is floating on it. So
losing the listeners at this point.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think so.
Well, it's fairly fundamental. I mean, you get takeovers at the top of a cycle, don't you? I mean, you know, that's when takeover fever takes hold. Mm. And you know, it may be that in actual fact, if you looked at where they're getting their money from, they're actually just you know, they're borrowing it and they haven't actually got the resources, and that'd be another reason why you would say, well, we don't want you to. I mean, they would then load up the follow-on company with debt. This is what's happened with football clubs and so on.
To bring things down to a bit more of a local perspective, Pfizer takeover bid sparks fears over 250 jobs at Avonmouth. That's in the Bristol Post on Wednesday. Claire Moody, Labour's leading Euro candidate in the South West, has expressed fears about loss of jobs in the Bristol area if AstraZeneca is taken over by the American firm Pfizer. They employ about 250 people at its site in Severn Road, Avonmouth. Ms. Moody has written to Filton and Bradley Stoke Tory MP Jack Lepresti, asking him if he believes a proposed takeover is a good idea. Stephen, I suppose this is your area. If you also have been looking down in Kent at job losses from Pfizer, do you think that's feasible, that Pfizer may close this place in Avonmouth?
Who knows? I don't know what they do at the Avonmouth factory, and I don't think the fundamental aim of Pfizer in merging or taking over AstraZeneca in the UK is to close down UK operations. It's just to run both of their entities more efficiently. I mean, it depends what they do at Avonmouth. It may not. It may complement Pfizer activities elsewhere. I think Ms. Moody is doing a bit of politic in here, particularly as you know, it's a bit hypocritical, to be honest, given it was her party that removed the general public interest test, which would be a lever that public policy lever that could be applied.
Okay, we're going to go back to back to Westminster for Wednesday for Prime Minister's Questions, where Prime Minister David Cameron and the leader of the opposition Ed Miliband were talking about rent controls.
There are 9 million people renting in this country. Our proposal is to say there should be fixed 3-year tenancies as the norm for those people with predictable rent changes, right? That is the proposal. Now, many people across this country think this is for the first time a party addressing the issue they face. So can he explain what is wrong from going from 1-year tenancies with unpredictable rent rises to 3-year tenancies with predictable rents? Why has the Conservative Party given up on millions of people who are generation rent?
What we want to do is build more houses so we have a better rental sector with more affordable rents. But as I said to him in my very first answer, if this is about finding new tenancies that give long-term security on a voluntary basis, yes. If it's about mandating rent controls for the centre and destroying the housing market, no. Now, the problem I have with so many of his policies is they all come from the same place. They come from the United... Thank you very much. Len, they come from the Unite Union. The Unite said, renationalise the railways. He wants to renationalise the railways. Unite says, let's have old-style rent controls. He wants old-style rent controls. The problem with rent controls is their policies are for rent, their candidates are for rent, and their leaders for rent. That's the problem.
Well, it descends into a bit of raucous shouting and screaming at that point, as quite so often happens at Prime Minister's Questions. But Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams, what are your thoughts about rent controls? Because for many people, it's really just simply not enough that they don't know that they're going to be able to stay in place where they are for the next 6 months.
Yes, although let's be clear in terms of what Miliband said, although he's allowed people to describe it as rent controls, I don't think that's actually what they've proposed. And he said in that clip, Labour were the first party to start talking about this. He obviously hasn't noticed the government announcements back in October last year about improving conditions in the private rental sector, a major consultation that we've just done, which I'm partially responsible for as a minister, that closed at the end of March, looking at sort of model tenancy agreements for tenants. We have already announced we're going to regulate letting agencies. An awful lot of the complaints about the private rental sector are to do with the activities of letting agents, particularly when they double charge people, when they charge the landlord for, say, doing a credit check, and they also charge the tenant as well. So we're looking at all of that and putting all of the letting agencies into a compulsory ombudsman scheme so people can make complaints about them. So a lot of activity from the government in the last 6 months has already been happening on the private rental sector. So Labour are actually behind the curve here.
Do you think it's a good idea to have 3-year minimum tenancies?
That's one of the proposals we've put out there to see what people think about it.
Well, the landlords should be. Landlords won't like it, will they?
Well, they might. They might. Whether if they think that means that a tenant will stay for a longer period of time, and the private rental sector, in some cases, the rent is paid perhaps by an employer or somebody else, so they might be looking for more certainty. You know, because obviously for them it's an investment, and people don't want constant churn of tenants, and the last thing they want is a gap. The private rental sector is growing around the country. In Bristol West, in my parliamentary seat, actually far more people rent in the private sector than they do in the social sector, and it's one of the biggest sort of shares of the housing market in the entire country. So it's very important to places like Clifton, Cottam and Redland, in particular the sort of conditions in the property themselves around electrical safety and checking the boilers and whatever, and that's something else that we're looking at the moment to make sure landlords are discharging their duty of care towards the tenants.
Martin, Ed Miliband's been criticised there. He just seems to be taking his script straight from Unite. First of all, it's nationalised railways, and now it's rent controls.
Well, the question is it a good idea or not? I mean, Unite are entitled to have their opinions about what should be happening, and some of those opinions will be taken up by the Labour front bench and some won't. I think it's good that we're actually talking about housing, because, of course, housing is a terrible mess in this country. The decision to sell off council housing stock in the 1980s and not replace it is coming home to roost for everybody. And, of course, we had 13 years of Labour government where very little was done to reverse these disastrous policies.
Very little is generous.
Yes, well, nothing.
Yes, that's
nothing at all. But I mean, what I would say is that therefore you see people like Len McCluskey and Unite are saying, well, we're absolutely frustrated with this. We've had 13 years of Labour government and nothing was done. We've now had several years of coalition government and we've still got a massive housing crisis because the whole policy has been wrong for a generation.
But this coalition government will be the first since Thatcher started selling off council houses to have more social and affordable homes in the housing stock at the end of this 5-year parliament than at the beginning. We've got a very ambitious building programme of affordable homes, and I've been opening some of them around the country. We've got a building development taking place in Wapping Wharf by M Shed in Bristol at the moment. There's a mixture of homes for sale, homes for the private rental sector, and homes for social rent as well. I want to see more sites like that being developed. But we are, by 2017, we'll be building affordable homes at the fastest rate for 30 years. So we're actually starting to reverse that decline in homes that are available for social and affordable rent. Whereas the Blair and Brown government, they did some good things. They sort of had a decent home standard for the remaining social housing stock and put in double glazing and better boilers and whatever, and that was a good thing. But they didn't build any new homes, and that's the big problem. What we need to do as a country, because our population is growing, not just because of immigration, the population is growing naturally, we need to build more homes, both in the private sector and the social sector.
But as you said yourself, Stephen, we've got more and more as buy-to-let. I mean, that means that there's less people are less able to own their own homes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan, personally, of buy to let. I want people to be able to own their own homes, because that's what most people actually want to do. Or if they don't want to own their own homes, they want to rent with some sort of guarantees about the future that they're going to be able to stay in their own home. And that's what I want to see. I'm not a big fan of buy to let personally.
Martin, how are we going to solve this problem? Because there doesn't seem to be really enough money to build much in the way of social housing, and you know, we just simply cannot house. We've got around about 15,000 people on the housing list in Bristol.
Well, what's beginning to happen is that all political forces are starting to bite the bullet of dealing with the problem of lack of affordable housing. I think there is a bit of a contradiction between having a social housing, increasing social housing policy, and things like Help to Buy, which are basically encouraging a property bubble. Ultimately, if you did have a big social housing programme, as the Conservative government had in the 1950s, that would stabilise house prices. So I think it's particularly pernicious that people in this country seek to use houses as a kind of pension plan. It's very distorting on the economy. Ultimately, we need to actually, poorer people, the poorer half of the population, cannot afford to house itself in the free market. So, and people used to recognise that across the political spectrum. We're now coming back to face reality after 30 years of not facing reality.
Yeah, and I'm trying to be too political in this context, but this government has an enormous affordable homes programme because the Lib Dems are in coalition. This is not something the Tories would have done if they'd been in power on their own.
Now, Andy Slaughter at the Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday brought up the issue of hospital closures.
Mr. Andy Slaughter.
I have two world-class hospitals in my constituency.
At the moment,
the Secretary of State for Health has decided that Hammersmith will lose its A&E this year, and the Charing Cross will be demolished, losing all consultant emergency services, including A&E and the country's best stroke units. Will the Prime Minister stop his health secretary putting my constituents' lives at risk?
What we are doing in North West London is making sure the NHS is getting more money. It's going to be getting £2.4 billion this year, £74 million than a year before. That, if you remember, his own party's policy was to cut the NHS like they are doing in Wales. The changes that are being made in North West London are backed by clinicians and local people, and we want to see our NHS improve as it does under this government.
Well, Martin, Old Age Oxford economist Martin Summers, your thoughts then on hospital closures? Because there's one part of London where an MP is pulling his hair out. He's saying, well, look, one A&E department's closing, another hospital is being demolished.
Well, there's always going to be arguments when things close. I think the question is the NHS safe in the hands of the current government? And I'm afraid it's not, because as David Cameron himself said before the last election, there will be no top-down reorganisation of the health service. But at the same time, he has brought in a top-down reorganisation, which will mean opening the health service up to international competition, all of which was not in his manifesto, and shouldn't be happening. And if you look at opinion polls, you'll see that most people don't want it to happen. So why is it happening?
Stephen, is the NHS being privatised?
No. And if anyone's been either in the BRI or just been around the BRI, it's pretty hard to miss if you're around the city centre, you notice huge investments going into that at the moment. A new cardiology unit has opened under this government. There's a major expansion of the oncology unit as well, and the children's hospital. There's massive investment going on in healthcare in Bristol. Of course, Southmead Hospital will be opening very soon, later this year. So we'll have fantastic state-of-the-art healthcare services in Bristol that are free at the point of the use to anyone. No one has to pay anything. So the health service is not being privatised. There's no charging scheme. It's not been sold to anyone. And this is emotive language, which I'm afraid is misleading people.
Well, what about, there are certain companies like Care UK, for example, that are setting up little private clinics which are now doing work for the NHS. But the trouble is, of course, if anything goes wrong in one of those clinics, if there's any kind of even the slightest complication, quite often the NHS then they have to be rushed back into the NHS, don't they?
Well, the key thing for patients, when people come to see me in my advice surgeries, when they're having to wait for, you know, a knee operation or some eye surgery, whatever it is. What they want is to be seen and for their ailment to be dealt with. They're not particularly bothered as such as to who does it, as long as it's freely available to them. And of course, in Bristol, we have the Independent Sector Treatment Centre out at Emerson's Green, which was created by the last government, particularly under the Blair part of that government. They wanted more competition within the health service itself, much of that being provided by private developers, and that's what the Emerson's Green Hospital is, and quite a lot of people in Bristol get their treatment there, but it is free to them. So there's always been a role for the private sector within healthcare. Of course, every GP surgery, or the vast majority of GP surgeries, are private businesses. They are professional partnerships in the same way as lawyers, accountants, architects, and other people.
Martin, I'll ask you the same question. Is the NHS being privatised?
I would say that it is, because ultimately the people may be treated for free, but somebody else is making a profit out of it. And in actual fact, that's ultimately opens you up to international competition law. So, for example, the new GP's commissioning organisations, that if they do not take the cheapest bid, then they can be taken to court in the EU and elsewhere under competition law. Now, in actual fact, the last government was wrong to pursue more competition in the NHS. This is, you know, when people say, well, the last Labour government agreed with this, the last Labour government brought these things in, they did. And of course, that is the problem, is it then becomes we all agree that this is what's got to happen. Now, in actual fact, the trade unions who fund the Labour Party have never been happy with that. And of course, we're now reaching a point where people are suddenly realising we should never have gone along with any of this. Now, of course, that's an internal fight for us. But I think ultimately, what people want, and what we want, what I want, is a properly national health service, which is actually not open to the private sector at all.
And what about these PFI deals, Stephen? We've got a massive PFI going on North
PFI
Bristol.
Deal.
I mean, do you think they're good value for money for the taxpayer, for the public?
I'm very sceptical about them. Of course, this government has not been entering into any new PFI schemes, and we are reviewing the contracts of all the deals that were signed under the last Labour government, which in some of them were quite scandalous, almost giving money away to the private sector. And for instance, an example in Bristol would be what we used to call Portway School, where that was rebuilt under a PFI scheme, and the academy sponsor there was guaranteed a payment per desk rather than per pupil. So you know, you could have notionally a school of 1,000 places, but with only a few hundred children, they got paid as if it was full, which everyone knew wasn't going to happen. This is the scandal of PFI. It allowed Gordon Brown to pretend that he was a prudent chancellor, to use his own word, when in fact he was anything but. As of course he was found out in the end when public sector borrowing went out of control, but he was actually borrowing even more via PFI, which he was keeping off the government's books. It was all a sort of facade that crumbled when we had the credit crunch.
On to another story, and a shocking poll shows almost 60% of young people will not vote in the next general election. That's in 2015, not the forthcoming European elections and local elections here. In an exclusive poll, only 41% of the estimated 3.3 million eligible first-time voters said they will turn up to cast their ballot. This is a poll for PA, that's Press Association, and in an exclusive poll, 3.3 million eligible first-time voters said they'll turn up to cast their ballot on Thursday, May the 2nd, next year. That is, next year. The number intending to vote this month's Euro election is even lower, at 30%. Survey of young Brits aged 17 to 21 underlines fears from the main parties that young people are increasingly disengaged from politics now. Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West. Why are young people so disengaged from politics? I mean, maybe one of the reasons is a lot of them that voted for the first time voted for the abolition of tuition fees, which your party promised and then reneged on.
Well, this is one opinion poll. I must say the finding is quite stark, to say that 60% of young people wouldn't vote for anybody. It's not just my party, wouldn't vote for anybody in a general
election. Use a sample
election.
Of 1,000 people.
All politicians find opinion polls interesting, but I've consistently for over 20 years been very sceptical about how much you can draw from a national sample of 1,000 people.
But a lot of young people say there's no difference, Stephen, between the main parties.
But it's not what I find when I'm talking to them. I do a lot of question and answer sessions with precisely this age group at schools and colleges in Bristol West. This is not what I find myself, and I don't think that's because Bristol West is peculiar compared to the rest of the country.
Do you find a lot of these children are not engaged? I mean, you're not engaged, don't turn up to these question and answer sessions?
I do find that a lot of people say that they don't like party politics at all. But then when you start to push back on that and say, what are you interested in? Suddenly you find they are interested in climate change. They are interested in third world development. They are obviously interested in their future education prospects and their job prospects. I say to them, well, that's politics. So you are interested in it. But I have a duty, as do all the other political parties, to get that across to people. And of course, I'm the MP who has tried twice to actually change the voting system to allow 16 and 17 year olds to vote in elections, and Parliament voted for that, so I got the motion passed in January last year, and not in time for the 2015 general election, but probably by 2016 we'll be enfranchising more young people.
But Stephen,
be surprised by how many of them do actually take an interest.
This poll,
puts
Lib Dems even behind UKIP, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think this poll is, I don't want to use a four-letter word at this time of day. It begins with, I think it's baloney. There was another word.
Martin, this is putting Labour at around about 40%. Conservatives about 20. UKIP next around about 10. And Lib Dem maybe around about 8, according to that. We've got a bar chart here.
Well, I mean, leaving aside who they might vote for if they did vote, I mean, the poll is also suggesting that 60% won't vote, which, of course, is very worrying. I believe 16-year-olds will be allowed to vote in the Scottish referendum.
Indeed, yeah.
And ultimately, I would say I would be in favour of 16-year-olds voting. But, of course, in that case, you've got to really beef up citizenship studies from 14 to 16. Yep. So, you are going to get a vote in 2 years' time, and you sit the 14-year-olds down and you really talk them through it. In Australia, voting is compulsory and has always been compulsory.
Mm. I'm not in favour of that because I'm a liberal. I don't think you should compel people to do something.
Well,
I think the challenge is down to all politicians, whether you're liberal, right wing, left wing, or whatever, to put forward things that people might want to vote for. I don't think you should force people to vote if they don't want to.
One of the things that we have discussed on this show in the past is if you were to bring in something like a citizen's income, we're not talking about citizen's income at the moment, but you could say, right, you don't have to vote, but in that case, you won't be able to claim any benefits. Now, in other words, it's not compulsory, but
I think that's why you're a socialist and I'm a liberal.
Well, quite possibly so, but I think ultimately it is worrying. And of course, what happens? I mean, the political parties look at the opinion polls especially the spin doctors and so on. And what happens is, if there's a choice between making the pain for elderly people who've already got some assets who will vote, or making more opportunities for young people with no qualifications who won't vote, the hard-hearted fact is that they will probably do what's necessary to help the elderly already privileged.
It's not,
and that is a real worry, because that means that everything begins to get distorted.
It's not entirely...
The whole political process doesn't take account of young people's needs.
And that's true.
And if they don't participate, they've only got themselves to blame.
Because it's not entirely surprising, but on personal issues, 45% of these young people worried most about finding a job. One of them is Dominic Webb, 21, who admits he had no intention of voting next year because he has no confidence that any political party will lift him out of unemployment.
Well, yes, and that's what I said. What most young people are concerned about when you talk to them is what are their education prospects and their job prospects after that.
Well, he says he's applied for 1,300 jobs, but most prospective employers simply don't apply.
It's hard to extrapolate from what one person says about their own personal experience right across the whole of young people. But the fact is the economy is in strong recovery. Unemployment has fallen consistently for over a year. Youth unemployment is falling as well. And also, because the government has raised the income tax threshold against which people start paying income tax because of the Liberal Democrats in government, it's now £10,000 you can earn without paying income tax. It means that starting salaries for young people means that they can now take far more of their pay.
But surely you must admit, Stephen, there aren't enough jobs to go around. I mean, Claire Stringer, 21.
30 million people now in work.
21, so also from Claire Stringer, this is a real person. Claire Stringer, 21, also from Southend, said, "I'm like every other teenager out there trying to find work, but there is just nothing. Or if there is something, I haven't got the qualification or that experience. I just want a chance."
Indeed. You can quote to me, if you wish, one young person from Southend-on-Sea in Essex, but I can tell you that the Bristol economy is strong, is growing, and there are lots of opportunities for young people in our city, and there are many more opportunities than there were a year ago, and far more opportunities than there were 4 years ago when we came into office. Unemployment in Bristol is now below where it was in May 2010.
Okay, Martin, what can we do for young people to actually give them a bit more of a motivation and also to get them some work when they want it?
Well, I mean, we could go on about the economy. I think this recovery is actually an unbalanced recovery, and it's likely to peter out.
Well, most
out
of them are
fail.
Concerned with the economy. To be fair, many yes, of them say of the economy is a big concern, and it's why I can't get a job.
Just a minute.
What would you do in order to actually change the way the economy is functioning? It would be something different to what these young people are experiencing at the moment. That would actually really increase the jobs market, make it possible for people to get jobs.
Well, if I was a standard sort of Labour politician type, I would say, well, what we're offering at the next election is that we're guaranteeing after a year we will provide you with a job, although I don't know whether that's even feasible. Ultimately, I think we're going to have to, I don't believe that we're ever going back to a full employment economy. That is a fantasy, frankly. I mean, the economy is still smaller than it was in 2008, so if we've got more people working than ever, productivity in the economy per worker must have collapsed, and it has collapsed. In other words, these jobs are rubbish jobs. Ultimately, we're going to have to provide
people...
It's
very hard to tell a person they've got a rubbish job.
Well, the jobs concerned, in competitiveness terms, these jobs are low wage, low skill, no development jobs. That's got to be the case because the economy's smaller than it was before the crash. It's just about to reach the same size, and we've got supposedly more people employed. That means per worker. Anecdotally, I know lots of people who are on working tax credit, for example. They're supposedly self-employed. Effectively, they are unemployed. They may be two, three hours a week.
Yes, well, you're right, Martin. The economy contracted. It was the biggest contraction in the developed world from 2007 to 2009. Our economy shrank by just over 7%, and unemployment shot up and kept shooting up until 2012. Now it's been falling, and the economy is growing. We're just about, probably in the next quarter this year, to get back to where we were in 2008. And that's been one hell of a task to climb out of the deepest hole that any major economy fell into. And then we'll start to see real wage increases come back through, which is what we all want to see, and more opportunities for young people.
But are you going to promise that before the election next year, the general election?
Well, it's happening, Tony.
Shooting up wages?
The economy is recovering. Real wages are now starting to grow again. You know, I'm not going to say there's a wonderful feel-good factor.
They're not quite shooting up, are they?
Clearly there isn't at the moment. But the rot was stopped. Recovery is underway. And now strong growth is where we're going to be going next. And I want everyone to feel that benefit.
Can I just say, the economy was growing when the coalition took over. And then, of course,
dead cat bounce.
But the economy was growing, and then it stopped growing, and now it's growing again. So it was growing under Labour, it stopped growing, and now it's growing again. But ultimately, not just in Britain, but in the US as well, this is all based on quantitative easing. Mario Draghi this week is hinting that he might, in fact, allow quantitative easing in the Eurozone, which has just about stabilised the euro. But ultimately, I'm with the free market Austrian economists on this. You can't print money to make the economy work. Ultimately, this will crash.
Okay.
And it may crash before the election, or it may crash after the election, but it will.
Okay. Back to the House of Commons, and this is a question about the disabled who are being hit by the bedroom tax.
This is Emma Lewell-Buck. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My constituent, Darren Lugg's disability, means he needs a specially adapted bed, so cannot share a room with his wife. Yet still, they are hit by the bedroom tax. Can the Prime Minister explain why this government is punishing him for his disability?
Prime Minister.
As the Honourable Lady knows, that we have the discretionary housing payments for exactly this sort of case, and the money has been topped up, so there's no reason for people to be disadvantaged in the way that she suggests.
Well, that was a quick answer. Stephen Williams, this is a real problem, though, isn't it? I mean, we're also seeing the front page of Inside Housing this week. Councils are rejecting 70,000 of these crisis fund requests to do with trying to help people pay the bedroom tax.
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a bedroom tax, of course. This is a change in housing benefit. It's one of the things I don't like about politics on either side, is sort of giving something a catchy name, which is then...
Well, it's what misleading. Everyone calls it, so right across the country.
Well, it is what Labour supporters and union supporters call it. That's true. What it is a reduction in housing benefit, because I think most people would accept the state has a responsibility to help people with housing costs and to house people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford housing, but not to give them more than
so
they actually
why are these
need.
Disabled so people being principle. Punished?
Well, they're not.
They are. Because
there are exemptions within recognised within the system, and what the Prime Minister you heard referred to there are discretionary housing payments. There's £500 million on the table for local authorities like Bristol and that one I think was in Sunderland to use to top up the benefit if there is a reason why somebody does need a second or a third bedroom. And the it's difficult to go into people's individual cases, but in the case that was mentioned at PMQs there, where someone does have a specially adapted bed because they can't share with their partner, that to me would seem a good reason why that discretionary housing payment should be made.
Okay, Martin, 70,000 requests to individual local authority crisis funds have been rejected this year.
Well, I think it's quite interesting because we've had Tim Kent on this show previously, who's the Lib Dem leader on the Bristol City Council, and he's not very happy with bedroom tax or whatever you want to call it, because it's actually a bureaucratic nightmare. Basically, you're saying people who are already in accommodation are going to have to move out and find somewhere else. That's always going to be cause problems. And there just isn't enough social housing to go around. We were talking about housing earlier. There's not enough. And I think that some of the policies that have been pursued by the government are basically misconceived and silly, and this is one of them.
More expensive, Steve,
well, exactly.
Put people in private accommodation if they have to move out of a social housing.
No, because what the biggest problem with housing that people come to see me about in my city centre constituency is that they are big families in small units, and they desperately need to move out of small one-bedroom flats, perhaps in the private sector, into two or three-bedroom houses in the social sector, and we need to match up these different needs across the population.
Well, let's hope
the city council, the housing associations,
let's
and
hope the spare room subsidy
need to make
does that anyway.
Well, it could well do.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest. You heard there, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. After the Murdoch News, Avon and Somerset Police advertising for business candidates to fill senior police jobs.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Rolf Harris's trial has been read a letter he's said to send to the father of one of his alleged victims, to the entertainer and told her parents years later. Lindsay Brown reports.
In the letter, the artist confesses to having a sexual relationship with the woman, but says it was consensual.
There was no rape, no physical forcing.
He describes being in a state of self-loathing for the misery he caused.
You can't go back and change things that you could have done in this life. I wish to God I could.
He ends with an apology.
I know that what I did was wrong, but we are all of us fallible, and oh, how I deluded myself.
The 84-year-old denies 12 charges of indecent assault against 4 girls.
Plans to let the taxman take money directly